There's a place in New York where you can walk through the actual front doors of the world's most famous recording studio, Abbey Road. Through those doors, past the Beatles, Pink Floyd, Radiohead, and countless other rock giants. Where can you find those doors? At the Hard Rock Cafe Times Square. The Abbey Road doors and thousands of other priceless pieces of rock history can be found at Hard Rock Cafes, Hard Rock Casinos, and Hard Rock Hotels around the world. To learn more, visit hardrock.com.
Little Steven's Underground Garage's coolest conversations, presented by Hard Rock Cafe, hosted by the Mighty Manfred.
This is the Mighty Manfred with you in Little Steven's Underground Garage, and it's time for another Coolest Conversations podcast presented by Hard Rock. Thanks for listening, and please remember to follow and subscribe, rate, and review. Joining me today for our chat is Cherie Curry, singer, songwriter, and actress, who back in the 1970s fronted the all-female rock band The Runaways. Their lineup also included the likes of Joan Jett and Lita Ford. Cherie's latest solo offering is titled Boulevards of Splendor, and it's available from Blackheart Records. It features a recent coolest song of the world, What Do All the People Know? So let's hear some of that now, and then I'll be back on the line with Cherie Curry for your Coolest Conversations podcast, presented by Hard Rock and Little Steven's Underground Garage.
You know I told you once tonight that you could always speak your mind. You work so hard to say what's right. I watch you do it all the time. When I call you on the phone, you said that talking in my sleep. Lately I am so confused, I really don't know what to do.
Mighty Manfred here, and it is a big day for our Coolest Conversations, because joining me is musician, actress, and artist Cherie Curry, who came to prominence initially as the lead singer of the 1970s all-female rock and roll band The Runaways. How are you, Cherie?
Oh, Manfred, I'm doing great. How about you?
Oh, I'm hanging in there. I mean, these last 2 months have been pretty wackadoodle. How have you been coping in this COVID world?
You know, I've been lucky, very well. You know, I haven't known anyone that was really, really sick. Besides the lockdown and kind of the nuttiness of all that, and I mean, we're just putting one foot in front of the other, right?
Oh, absolutely. So we've also got these crazy fires out here in California. Overall, are you making do in these end times then, between the fires and the virus?
Well, you know, my wonderful ex-husband, Robert Hayes, and my son, Jake, lost their house in the Woosley fire. So we've been touched deeply by these fires. And my heart just goes out to all of these people. It's just tragic. I mean, there's really nothing quite like losing everything that you have had. But, you know, my son, he never even shed a tear about it. He just realized that everything is just material and that can be replaced. And I mean, he's really taken quite a profound stance on it that just really, I mean, you know, we learn from our kids.
Yeah. Well, how old is your son?
He's going to be 30 in February.
Okay. Now, your mom was an actress back in the 1940s. I think her half-sister, Sandra, also an actress. You've done acting. Of course, you're a singer. Your twin sister, Marie, a singer and actress in her own right. What was life like growing up in a showbiz family, or would you not characterize it that way?
Oh, no. My mom had actually been blackballed from the business. that rebellious streak in her, you know, she was signed to Republic and she fought them on a contract and they just blackballed her. And let me tell you, that's a shame because she was talented. Mm-hmm. And I was completely unaware of my mother's talent until after I had left the acting business in the mid 80s when I saw some of her films. She never showed us films. So I didn't know, but she was so brilliant. And had I seen some of the movies that my mother had done, I probably would have stuck it out.
Mm-hmm. And is your mom still with us, or did she pass away?
Well, I'm going to say she is still with us, but she's going to be 97 in October, and she has Alzheimer's, dementia. And she has not spoken our names in almost 8 years. And it's just the worst thing to see. You know, I feel it is terrible for anyone that has to deal with this disease, dementia or Alzheimer's, because she can't move or do anything or speak, or it's pretty awful. So, I mean, a part of me looks forward to her being released from that at this point.
Right. Well, how did your parents take it when you became lead singer of a rock band at about age 15? Were they supportive of that, or was it like absolutely no way?
Well, my mom was just getting married, remarried to Wolfgang Kolpisch, a German, and moving to Indonesia, taking my brother, wanted to take my sister and I, my twin and myself as well. But of course, I just signed with Mercury. And my dad, who had been living in Texas, came back here to live in my little Aunt Debbie's house. And so my twin sister and I, and my grandmother and my Aunt Debbie, and my grandmother shared a bed. Marie and I had a room, and my dad had it was a tiny little house. I don't know, maybe 1,300 square feet, but it was a house full of love. My dad would never, ever, ever have tried to stop this, because he was a very wonderful singer. And in fact, Bing Crosby's brother, who had a record company, had offered him a record deal. But my dad just didn't believe that he had the chops, I guess. I don't know. But you know, he wasn't thrilled. And trust me, when my son turned 16 and asked if he could go on the road with his cousin Trevor Lukather, I said, "How would you like your no, fast or slow?" Not a chance. I was going to let him go on his own. But, you know, I had a lot of support. I'm going to say the creep factor was pretty high for my aunt and my grandmother and my dad when it came to Kim Fowley and just, but the thing is that, you know, we had a contract and we were making a real record. And so what are they going to say? All the parents of the Runaways, they wanted us to have this dream.
Yeah. Well, you know, Kim was actually on the air here in the Underground Garage for a number of years before he passed away. I imagine he must have been a pretty smooth talker when he was dealing with your parents and the adults in your life.
You know, I helped take care of Kim towards the end of his life. I moved him into my house, and it was the best thing I ever could have done. You know, I had to forgive him, because I realized that all that anger in me was only hurting me. And I got to really know him and make a record with him before he died. You know, he was brilliant. And as far as a songwriter, I've never met anyone like him. Like Cherry Bomb, word for word, out of his mouth in one swoop. This is how he wrote songs. And anyone that was lucky enough to have a guitar with, you know, sitting next to him got half of that writing. But it was really Kim. Kim just was a brilliant lyricist, bar none.
Certainly, certainly so. And also just quite the character. I mean, he definitely cut a swath and a figure wherever he went. I believe, well, actually, I can't believe that it's already been 10 years since that Runaways biopic that starred Dakota Fanning as yourself, Kristen Stewart as Joan Jett. Were you happy with how that turned out? You know, was the retelling authentic enough for you?
Well, I think that with any film, you have to turn over the rights for them to change things that they feel that need to be changed. And I mean, how do you talk about a couple of years of chaos and nuttiness and put it into, 90 minutes? The thing is I was so happy that my new adult version of Neon Angel came out at the same time. Mm-hmm. That was the only way I could really live with it, because, I mean, the acting was superb. Floria Sigismondi captured the 70s in a brilliant way, but I thought the story could have been far deeper. It was a profound experience, and to me, that wasn't really captured in the movie, but the movie is good. You know, again, look, I wrote the book. I wrote the book, and anyone that reads my book or gets my new audio book, Neon Angel Memoir of a Runaway, will see that it just scratched the surface.
Well, I was going to ask you about the memoir. So it is still in print, and there's also now an audio book version available. Is that correct?
Actually, my book has been number one on Amazon consistently for a couple of months. Yes, it is still in print, hard copy, and the paperback version, which has some extra chapters. And then also the audiobook was just released a couple of weeks ago.
Okay. In fact, I was going to ask you if there were any new chapters. They're all very cool. Around 1980, that's when you had your first album with your twin sister, Marie. It came out, that's Messing with the Boys. And that year, you also debuted on the silver screen in the coming-of-age movie Foxes with Jodie Foster. You had some other acting gigs, but I just found out that you had a small role in Spinal Tap, and it didn't make the final film, but that footage is like up on YouTube. Do you have any memories, recall anything about being in Spinal Tap?
Oh, of course. You know, that was so much fun. And, you know, Rob Reiner, bless his heart, because he actually went on Whoopi Goldberg's show, and she had asked about, you know, anything that he regretted about the edits he had to make. And he said that the number one regret was that because he had 4.5 hours of film and he had to cut, and that he cut my character out because all the guys, you see them showing up with herpes sores on their mouths. And that's all from me, because I'm the opening act for Spinal Tap. I loved Rob, and I also ended up doing all the commercials for the film as well. But I had so much fun making that film.
Very cool. So they listed you. So you were supposed to be the lead singer in a band called Dose. I couldn't figure out whether it was kind of new wavy or a punk band. Was that the gist of it?
I guess so. I mean, I guess I you know, to Dose, a dose of herpes. I don't know.
Well, along with being a musician and an actress, I mentioned you being an artist, and in fact, you're an award-winning chainsaw artist. So, you Renaissance woman, how did you get involved with working with a chainsaw, doing chainsaw art?
Well, it was just a fluke. I had everything that has ever happened in my life besides the Runaways, the book, everything came from art, because when I was a counselor for drug addicted teens back in the mid 80s, I had to sit in classroom with them for a couple of hours, and I started sketching, and they were all whimsical, you know, with colored pencil, you know, princes and princesses with castles and in harmony with animals. And so my then manager, Rick Frio, took me to Priester and Sloan as a child's book artist. And when they asked how long I'd been drawing, and I said a year, and they said, how is that possible? And I told them the story. They said, well, we've been looking for our first young adult book, and this is it. So I walked in as a potential artist for Priester and Sloan and walked out an author. And because of that book, because of my art, that book happened. And then after I had got married and I continued to draw, then I started painting, and then I started relief carving, which is just a two-dimensional, like tabletops and wall hangings. And then I was going to Malibu one day and happened to see a couple of guys chainsaw carving at the side of the road. And this voice in my head would not let me alone. I mean, every night I went to bed, you have to go back, you have to go back. And finally I did, and I walked into their gallery and just saw these amazing carvings. I mean, it wasn't like the crude lumberjack type, you know, squared off bears. And we're talking just beautiful mermaids, and this voice, that wonderful voice we all need to listen to, said, you can do this. And it shocked me. I mean, it really took me aback, because a chainsaw, I mean, But I said, okay. And so I talked to the owner, and he looked at some of my artwork, and he hired me on. Wow. And I almost immediately started winning ribbons, and then I started competing in 2005 and placing in major competitions, and I've been a carver ever since.
Well, if I've got this timeline right, you had a bad accident in 2016, something involving falling off a scaffold while working with a chainsaw, and that wound up postponing the release of Boulevards of Splendor, the album. What happened exactly?
Well, I was up on a scaffold. I needed to get just a couple of inches higher. Mm-hmm. And my assistant had put a plank with a 4x4 underneath it. Unfortunately, it placed them wrong. And instead of, you know, for it to be vertical, he put them horizontal, so they ran in the same direction as the plank, and he was supposed to hold the scaffold, that, you know, the plank of wood while I was up there.
Right.
And at that moment, my client's wife called him over to do something ridiculous, and I guess I caught an edge, is what they call catching an edge. I was carving the foot of a bear, and so that's when the saw blade grabs the wood and pulls you forward.
Okay.
And so the scaffold collapsed under me, and I don't remember the fall because it knocked me cold, but I know that I fell backwards. I broke my tailbone on the back of the scaffold, and with the chainsaw running, I held it. Obviously, I held it out in front of me. I fell onto my left side of my face, and my forehead and my right shoulder took the brunt onto the sidewalk. So it did some pretty good damage to my face, but I have recovered. It is pretty miraculously, to be honest, because I had facial paralysis for a year.
Okay. There was a lot of physical therapy afterwards as well?
Well, I did it for myself. You know, I mean, because I couldn't smile. When I smiled, the left side of my face wouldn't smile.
Right.
So I just worked my cheek muscle on that side until, you know, I mean, I still have a little bit of deadening under my left nostril and under my chin a little bit, but you can't notice.
So you get healthy, and before Boulevards of Splendor comes out, you meet Bree Darling of the all-female 70s band Fanny, and you guys do this album, The Motivator. So how did you meet Bree, and were you familiar with Fanny before you guys met?
Yes, I was familiar with Fanny, especially back in the Susie Quattro days. I knew of them. Again, I'd heard a couple of songs. Their type of music really wasn't my type of music.
Yeah,
I was a huge Susie Quattro fan, but I was asked to come and sing backgrounds on Fanny Walks the Earth. And I knew that a lot of the girls from the Go-Go's and the Bangles were singing on it. And Patty Quattro had actually reached out to me and asked if I wanted to participate. And I did. But when I got their single, I just thought, who is that singer? I mean, why isn't she a major star? I mean, I really loved Bree's voice. And when I walked into the studio, I walked up to the producer, who turned out to be her husband, Dave Darling. And I said, where's the singer? I just want to compliment her. And that kind of made her a little uncomfortable. I guess women really don't give each other the kudos that they deserve, which I feel is very sad. Me, I just, if I think you're great, I'm going to tell you, period, you know, and that just, also, I stepped out a little bit singing-wise with the girls because we were doing a lot of group vocals. And I caught the eye of Dave Darling and Bree. And so they had me do another session solo. And Dave just knew that he wanted us to make a record.
Yeah.
And that's what happened.
Very cool record, that title track, The Motivator. I really love that. Now, who wrote that, The Motivator?
Oh, The Motivator, that's T-Rex.
Okay, right. So that makes sense.
I mean, Dave Darling, what he did for that song, and Dave is a six-time Grammy-nominated, producer, And I just think what he did for that song is outstanding. And I was really sad. I really thought that one had a chance of doing something. But, you know, this business has changed so much from the, you know, the 80s where you could actually get a hit record. Now it's just, I think, politics and grooming and big money. And, you know, it's pretty rare that anyone can just have a hit. It just is, unfortunately.
Well, so Motivator comes out last year, and your album Boulevards of Splendor is issued as well, but it's just available on Record Store Day of last year. The vinyl version comes out, and I know that it's available in a digital form now from Blackheart Records, came out this past April. Was the vinyl also on Blackheart?
Oh, yeah. Yes, it was. I believe it was. You know, I never really thought this record would ever come out. I mean, I'm really being honest with you. I mean, it's been 9 years that it had been shelved, and I didn't understand why that had happened, because between I finished the record in 2010 and just about the cusp of 2011, and they just wouldn't release it. So, and to be honest with you, I mean, right before I met Bree, I at my house, I was putting my house up for sale, and I was going to buy some land up north and build a couple cabins and be a chainsaw artist the rest of my life. I mean, I want it out of this business.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, you know, Boulevards is a great record. I mean, it is the record I always wanted to make when I left the Runaways, that, you know, teaming up with my sister didn't produce that kind of record, even though it was a good record. You know, and my sister decided she didn't want to be in the business before tour started. So that was a huge setback. And that was pretty much the end of my career at that point. So I was so excited about this record coming out, and the fact that it just never did took a toll on me for sure.
Well, let's talk. We can talk some about the record specifically. You've got a number of guests, collaborators on there with you, including Billy Corgan of Smashing Pumpkins, Slash and Duff from Guns N' Roses. There's Juliette Lewis on there. Brody Dahl, the Australian musician, got the Veronicas contributing as well. Guns N' Roses producer, or drummer, excuse me, Matt Sorum, produced a lot of the tracks. You said it was done by, did you say by 2010 is when the initial recordings were finished? Is that right?
Yeah, right at the end of 2010, the beginning of 2011, it was finished.
So when did you start working on it in earnest?
Right after I opened for Joan Jett at the Pacific Amphitheater. And it was a fluke again of how Matt even got involved. When I was touring on the Runaways movie, Matt had phoned me to do some singing on his now wife's Aces record. Uh-huh. And I had missed that opportunity because I was out of town. So when I called him back, Kenny and Joan had just asked me to open for her at the Pacific Amphitheater, which I believe was March of 2010. And I only had about 3 weeks to put together a band. So I asked Matt if he knew any musicians, because I've been out of the business for a long time.
Yeah.
And he said, well, I'll be your drummer and I'll put together a band for you. And I just was shocked. I mean, I fell out of my chair. And sure enough, he brought on Nick Mayberry and Grant Fitzpatrick. And I brought my son Jake in, who at that time was 19. And Matt worked us to the bone in those rehearsals. And I think when we walked out on that stage opening for Joan, just blew everybody away. I mean, it was a great show. And I just never worked again after that.
Wow.
I went into the studio and made the record, but I never really did another show.
Well, I'm sorry we're in the midst of this COVID world, because you need to be out playing these tracks. So our coolest song in the world this week is titled What Do All the People Know? And it's one of the several bonus cuts available on the album. It was done first by the Monroes back in like 1982, and they were from San Diego. Do you remember the song from back then?
Of course I do. Of course. And in fact, I've actually become a pretty good friend with David, you know, who wrote the song.
Yeah.
And I love the tune. I really, really did. This was Kenny Laguna. Right after I'd finished the album with Matt, mm-hmm. I knew that this album deserved a great, great, great sound. And Tom Panunzio is just a master at getting, you know, the kind of sound that Boulevards has now. I think Matt wasn't too happy with me doing that, but I knew it deserved it. So we went back into the studio with Tom Panunzio, and Kenny took over to produce a couple of tracks, which one of them was What Do All the People Know?
Well, what was, you know, Kenny, of course, we're talking about Kenny Laguna, Joan Jett's longtime producer and collaborator. What was it like working with Kenny?
Yeah, I mean, we became pretty good friends in like 1997, 98, when we decided, they reached out, Joan and Kenny reached out to me to sue Kim Fowley and Mercury and for the rights to the Runaways and to start getting royalties, because we never did.
Oh, yeah.
And so that's how we became friends. And then Kenny and I just became very, very close. And anytime he came out, he would stay at my house, and he was a dear, dear, dear friend to me for a lot of years before the movie. And he believed in my book, and he shopped my book for a movie, which, you know, nobody really believed it would happen, but he made it happen.
Well, we love Kenny here in the Underground Garage. We've spoken with him a number of times, and enjoy all this. You know, he's got all sorts of oddball projects, producing things he's done over the years. And if you talk to Kenny, it's like, wow, you work with so-and-so and you did what? I mean, it's really fascinating, his career as well. So thinking about the Monroes, so their version of the song is great, but I way prefer the tune with, you know, guitars up front and without that kind of 80s synth sound going on there. How about yourself?
Well, you know, there's a nostalgia to 80s music. And if you like 80s music, you love it, and you love it for the rest of your life. I was never a big 80s fan, but I have started to become more of an 80s fan as of late. But still, I would never be in an 80s band, so I'm still a pretty good, just a rocker. I mean, I'm a huge 70s classic rock type of person myself. So I do love the guitars and the crunchiness and all that. And I kind of, it's funny when you bring up this song, because this song wasn't even finished when we were putting it out, because this digital release was, I think, a kind of a last minute thing with Blackheart because of the shutdown. And so when I listened through the record, I realized that there was no solo on the solo section of What Do All the People Know. And we had to scramble to find, you know, the one with all the vocals, and they were going to put it out with just a couple of vocals on it. And just nobody was aware that they had the wrong track. And then I made a phone call to Nick Mayberry. We're in total lockdown. And I said, Nick, you got to put a solo on this song. And he did it in his apartment.
Great.
And we got it over to Blackheart, and that's what you have there.
So, in fact, I meant to ask you, who's singing backing vocals on the track?
Well, I am. And I believe Jake Hayden, who played drums on the song, did, I think, you know, What Do All the People Know?
Yeah, because there's a dude's voice on there.
Jake Hayden.
Yeah. So also, we talked about, you know, this record you did with Bree, Motivator, and it's a T-Rex tune. And so on Boulevards of Splendor, you've got a version of the Sweeney Todd glam thing, Roxy Roller. What a great track. Speaking of backing vocals, Julie Reagan's is singing backing vocals on that. Now, who is she?
Julie Reagan. She has worked with me. In fact, I just made a phone call to her. And she just sang on a song, a video that Dave Schultz and I are just about ready to release for the song, What the World Needs Now is Love,
yeah.
The old Jackie Shannon song.
Right.
And Julie, I had met her singing at a little restaurant over 20 years ago, and her voice is something like nothing I'd ever heard. There's a little tiny white girl who sings like Aretha Franklin. And she started singing on stuff for me that I'd written and other projects, either they were charity projects or like Believe. I'd written a song called Believe where she just breaks out. And in fact, I actually had done this live with like a choir, and she stood out and sang these, this entire choir of of gospel singers just turned around and went, woo, I mean, she's so talented. So I had asked Julie to come and sing live with me when I opened for Joan for Roxy Roller. And because I couldn't, you know, we couldn't find anyone that could hit that note.
Yeah.
And except Julie. So Julie and I, yeah, so it was really neat to reconnect with her just these last couple of weeks as well. And she's in the video and she's just brilliant.
So you wrote the track on the album, You Wreck Me. Is that correct?
Yeah.
And this standout was one of the standout tracks. And I also wanted to ask you about who wrote Bad and Broken. Was that you as well?
No. And unfortunately, I don't have the name of the woman that wrote those lyrics. But I think Holly Knight and Matt wrote the music.
Mm-hmm.
And Matt knows this amazing lyricist, which I have to tell you, her lyrics, when I read them, I mean, I was floored that this gal could come up with this. And that's one of my favorite tracks on the record. And I'm sorry I don't have the information in front of me of who she is, but truly a brilliant songwriter.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, let's talk a moment about You Wreck Me. That's one that you did write, and I'm assuming that's a relationship song, a breakup song maybe?
It was, and in fact, it was in real time. And I wrote those lyrics, I think, in about 20, 30 minutes. And I had the melody in my head, and I called Matt, and I sang it to him over the phone. He goes, get over here. And we wrote the music around that, the lyrics and the melody.
Very cool. And Mr. Billy Corgan, responsible for the title track, Boulevards of Splendor?
What a wonderful man. And you know what? I had just the last couple of months there, I think it's Breaking the Band or something was on television, Smashing Pumpkins, and I watched it.
Uh-huh.
And I was floored because, you know, he doesn't have a great reputation with a lot of people. But I have to tell you, my experience with Billy was a man of just giving not only of his time and talent, but even after we had done the song, recorded it, I had reached out to him with a song that my son and I had written, and he was in some location in the mountains songwriting alone. And he took the song that Jake and I wrote and with it videotaped some changes he thought should be made. What a giving, incredible human being he is. I mean, I never saw any ego. I never saw anything but a man that just wanted to make music better. And it was an honor to work with Billy.
Oh, man, very cool. Now, you may not know this, Cherie, but you and I are all on a song together. Did you know that?
No.
Well, we are. And it's this tune, recent thing that Frank Myers wrote called Flatten the Curve. And I know there's like 30 plus people on there, but, you know, yourself and Mike Watt and Eddie Spaghetti and Josie Cotton. I should remind people that the song was conceived of as a sort of a COVID lockdown benefit tune, and the proceeds from the track from Flatten the Curve go to benefit the Jubilee Consortium and the Sweet Relief Musicians Fund. And so my involvement is because I have a side project band in L.A. called The Magnificent, and the bass player is Bruce Duff. And Bruce, of course, the guy that produced it and helped arrange everything, line everything up. And that's how I wound up on it. How did you get involved in the project?
Well, Bruce is great. But Frank and I had been friends for, oh, my goodness gracious, almost 30 years. Because I worked with the Cheetahs, the Streetwalking Cheetahs. They had asked me to come up on a gig, gosh, I think 1992. To do Cherry Bomb. And from that moment on, Frank and I remained very good friends. And I've done a lot of session work for him. And when he was working for a magazine, I came in and did a really cool thing where I got to dress up as David Bowie and they put a lightning bolt across my face. Cool. I mean, Frank is just a dear, dear soul. So when he reached out to do this, you know, I mean, I would never say no to Frank, ever.
Of course not.
And to be honest, I was swamped right at that moment because Boulevards had just come out. And I was, if I wasn't recording, I was doing interviews. And so I fit in you know, got in there and did it like it in 10 minutes, whatever I could do for him, you know. And I think, you know, I just love Frank. I love him.
Yeah, absolutely. Very good man. And we're talking about that song, Flatten the Curve, but we need to take a listen to another song off of Boulevards of Splendor. It's another bonus track. It's a version of the Runaway song, Queens of Noise. And now, how is this a tribute to the late drummer Sandy West, Runaways drummer Sandy West?
Well, first of all, whenever I did do shows, I didn't do many, but when I did, of course, I had some original material, but any Runaways material I ever did, I made sure Sandy was on the drums because there was just no one like her. And she and I remained best friends up until the end. And she was a fantastic drummer. And Matt Sorum, who, you know, is just off the charts, really wanted to pay homage to her. So he didn't change a thing. He played it because Sandy, now, Queens of Noise was written by Billy Bazeau of The Quick. Mm-hmm. And he wrote it actually, you know, for me to sing, even though Jones sang it on the record.
Right.
But Sandy was the only person that ever put sticks to skin on that song. And he really played it exactly the way Sandy had written it. And so that was really very, very touching and important that song be dedicated to her.
So was it Matt that suggested you guys do it, or who made the suggestion of doing the song?
Well, we discussed it. I mean, I thought Queens of Noise would be perfect.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I mean, it was just a discussion. I mean, that was the standout song and very rock and roll. And then Matt made some phone calls and brought in Brody Dahl, who was actually pregnant at the time and one of the great people to work with. And then Juliette Lewis, who is a very good, again, all these people that were brought in on this record were all Matt's friends. I didn't have a little black book of friends. I mean, I had been just a carver. I hadn't really been in the business. So all these people that were brought in were Matt's friends. And it's so funny about Juliette Lewis, because she actually asked me to leave the studio when she sang, because I guess I made her nervous. I don't know why, but I wasn't in the studio when she sang, except for when we sang together for a little clip here and there. But
the Veronicas, were they on that track too?
Yeah, they certainly are. And they are, they're also from Australia, twins. And one of the girls was dating Billy. So they just came and they've just light up a room. Anytime they came in that studio, it was just smiles and excitement. It was really a great record to make for me. I mean, it was everybody coming together, wanting to give everything they had for this record. And it was very humbling to me that these people would contribute their great talent to this record.
Has there been any, I mean, the digital version of the album came out this past April. Have you thought about doing any kind of live streaming?
Well, that's just very difficult right now.
Yeah.
I mean, we're doing some quarantine videos, Rock and Roll Oblivion. We're just finishing up on that one. We did do Roxy Roller. Roxy Roller, that was released, I think, three months ago.
Mm-hmm.
And I reached out to Susie Quattro. She is singing on it. And Nick Gilder, who wrote the song, he is also singing on it. You've got to check it out. It's a great video because it's live. I mean, there was no lip syncing, anything like that. My son and I sat down in his studio with a camera and we just one pass through. I sang, went up to harmonies where I knew Susie was coming in or Nick. And it's a really great video. I've got fantastic players on it. Nick Mayberry, of course, my son, Jake Hayes, Phil Levitt from Seven Horse and Dada, and Joey, who is in Seven Horse, who plays guitar. He played bass in it. And then we had a Isaac, this 17-year-old kid, who just is a master at editing. He edited together this video, and you should really check it out. It's great.
Well, we're definitely going to check it out. And Cherie, I want to thank you again so much for speaking with me today, talking with me today on our Coolest Conversations.
Well, you've been swell, and thank you so much. And I really appreciate all the support.
Oh, you, well, it's well deserved. And such a cool person. I have so enjoyed chatting with you the last few minutes. Now, here's Cherie Curry with her version of Queens of Noise off the latest solo album, Boulevards of Splendor, in Little Steven's Underground Garage. Of Noise from Cherie Curry here in Little Steven's Underground Garage. Her version of the Runaway song is part of her latest album, Boulevards of Splendor, and it's a tribute to her former Runaways bandmate, drummer Sandy West. This is the Mighty Manfred, and thanks again to Cherie for speaking with me today on our Coolest Conversations. Thanks also to Olivia Callahan for producing our podcast, and join me next week when I will talk with Ryan Hamilton of Ryan Hamilton and the Harlequin Ghosts. Their new album is called Nowhere to Go But Everywhere, and we'll find out all about it next time on your Coolest Conversations podcast, presented by Hard Rock and Little Steven's Underground Garage.
There's a place in New York where you can walk through the actual front doors of the world's most famous recording studio, Abbey Road. Through those doors, past the Beatles, Pink Floyd, Radiohead, and countless other rock giants. Where can you find those doors? At the Hard Rock Cafe Times Square. The Abbey Road doors and thousands of other priceless pieces of rock history can be found at Hard Rock Cafes, Hard Rock Casinos, and Hard Rock Hotels around the world. To learn more, visit hardrock.com.